It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. He's got reports of some of the hacks revealed at Black Hat and DEF CON. We'll also find out why speculative execution is something that's going to plague all processors for the foreseen future. I don't know what we're going to do about that. And then an AI bot designed to find security flaws. They're turning it against the Great Firewall of China. It's all coming up next on Security Now. Security Now comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 779, recorded Tuesday, August 11th, 2020, Geneva. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. And by privacy.com. Privacy lets you make purchases online using virtual cards instead of real ones, protecting your identity and bank information on the internet. New customers get $5 to spend on their first purchase when they go to privacy.com/securitynow to sign up. And by IT Pro TV. Get the best well-rounded IT education from the experts. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use the code SN30 at checkout. It's time for Security Now, the show we cover your security now with this guy now right here, Steve Gibson. He is the guru of Security Now and has been for these 15 years. Oh. Is that next week that we're going to celebrate that?
I think it is. I looked at it a couple of weeks ago, and it's not on the day, but it's a plus or minus one day. So I think next week, 780 is the end of our 15th year. And then the next podcast, 781, begins year 16. Wow. But this week, we're at 779. For August 11th, and a really interesting topic. You wouldn't know from the name of the podcast, Geneva, what this is about. And we're going to tease it a little bit for our listeners. But we have a lot to talk about. We're going to note the completion of the first virtual Black Hat and DEF CON conferences. And there was some news that came out of there, but on close examination, nothing really stunning. Like even that satellite, you know, the guy that had been monitoring satellite communications forever and spotted a few things that were in the clear. It's like, yeah, well, okay. If you watched any communications channel for a long time, you'd see some leakage. But anyways, we'll talk about that. We're also going to examine the latest academic work to emerge from our friends at the Graz University. They have dramatically advanced our understanding of the past few years of performance optimizing processor vulnerabilities. Basically, they stepped back and realized everyone had been wrong about what they thought the problem was. They generalized it and as a result have found a new set of attacks which apply to all processors, Intel, AMD, IBM, it doesn't matter, ARM, just across the board. We're also going to take a look at what we know about the ransomware attack on Canon, a mishandled vBulletin vulnerability disclosure, which was just unconscionable. We're seeing that, you know, again. We have the forthcoming support for DOH on Windows 10. Also, the result of Troy Hunt's year-long quest to find a new home for his much-loved Have I Been Pwned services. And some interesting insight thanks to his posting about that. We've got a bit of miscellany, some feedback, and an update on my SpinRite work. Then we're going to examine a very interesting new technology being used to evade state-based internet censorship, which is what Geneva is the acronym for. So I think a really interesting couple hours for our listeners.
So it's not a hack.
An oldie but goodie.
It's a good thing, Geneva.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I think, in fact, when I saw the picture of the week, I thought, maybe we've done this before, but maybe not.
We have, but not for a while, and it's
a classic.
You've got to say, what is the story it's behind this one?
It would get, let's put it this way, a security scorecard of F, as low as you can get.
Yes, and it's reminiscent of the gate in the middle of the path where that you can see the foot traffic that just walked around the gate because, okay, again, what were they thinking?
All right, we're going to get to it. It's going to be a good show, obviously. We're going to get to that in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Security Scorecard. I was looking at Twitch Security Scorecard. My security posture is good considering we're in the entertainment industry, but it's a B. This is a really cool service. Security Scorecard is the global leader in something maybe kind of new, cybersecurity ratings. It's the only service where 1.5 million companies are rated, and not just once, but continuously. And they want to change the world. Their mission is literally to empower every organization with collaborative security intelligence. No one can do it on their own. You've said this many times. If you're rolling your own security, you're rolling your way into trouble. Yeah. You need some help. Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through this single pane of glass, the dashboard, that will tell you exactly how you're doing and where the problems lie. Their patented rating technology is used by over 1,000 organizations, and actually it's for many, many use cases by each. You could do self-monitoring with Security Scorecard ratings. You evaluate your own organization's cybersecurity risk using data-driven, objective, measurable, quantifiable metrics that are continuously evolving that provide visibility into your organization's information security control weaknesses. But, you know, there's another reason. Uh-oh, there's our F. Fortunately, maybe unfortunately, our F is in application security. We can dig into the 51 issues found. But in many cases, those applications aren't controlled by us. So in everything that we've got that we've controlled, I think we're okay. We've got an A, and that's why we got a B. We got one F, and all the rest were A's. Third parties use this as well for risk management. You can, if you're thinking of doing business, let's say you're looking at a cloud service provider, wouldn't you want to know how carefully they manage their passwords and, you know, how carefully they protect your data? Well, you can get their security scorecard and find out. Instantly view the cybersecurity posture of any third-party vendors, partner, or suppliers, so you know what the risk is in your ecosystem, sometimes even before you buy. And of course, it allows them and you to fix any cybersecurity risks and vulnerabilities. What is nice is I'm just showing the top level of my security scorecard rating. And it's a great dashboard. One of the big uses of this is, let's say you got to go to your board and say, look, we're considering partnering with this company. They're going to legitimately say, tell us about their security posture. You say, I've got their report card right here. And it's a great, easy to read dashboard. So you can report to executive level or board. It's great for insurance, for cyber insurance underwriting. And here's the thing. Security Scorecard is collecting this data all the time, non-intrusively, from publicly available feeds across the internet. So what you're getting is the outside-in perspective. And that's kind of what you want. You know, it's not enough to just to ask the provider, tell me about your security posture. You want to know what it looks like from the outside. You'll get 10 key risk factor groups. You get scores A through F. Actually, there's no E. It's just like school. A, B, C, D, or F in things like patching cadence. How rapidly and how accurately do they patch? Application security. How, if they're DNS, if they use DNS, how well they're doing that? Is it secure? Their DNS health, network security, endpoint security. Companies with a C, D, or F in any of those areas are 5 times more likely to be breached. You don't want to see that. And if you're thinking about doing business with them, you don't want to do business with them. And if it's your company, you might want to check. I, of course, immediately went to Russell and Patrick and our engineers and said, okay, let's look into this. I don't like this F. Good job on everything else, though. Security Scorecard believes every business has the right to its own security rating. SC Magazine gave it their best product in security ratings 2020 award because you can get this for free right now for your business and up to 5 others. The combined power of Security Scorecard ratings and Atlas gives organizations a 360-degree view of cybersecurity for any company in the world. 1.5 million companies. Sign up for your free account right now, securityscorecard.com/twit. At least find out what your posture is. And anybody you're doing business with, you could check the score of your business and up to 5 others right now free. To learn more, sign up for your free account. It's really awesome. I think this is a great company. I talked to them for quite a while because I really wanted to understand what they do. You can learn more on the website about how they do it. There is a – you can get a paid full platform demo if you want, and I think many companies do. It's a really useful tool. But the free tool at least is a good place to start. Get your security scorecard right now. securityscorecard.com/twit. Sign up for that free account. Steve?
Okay, so our blast from the past, oldie but goodie picture of the week is – I mean, it looks authentic. Maybe the whole thing is a spoof, but if nothing else, it's fun. It's an 8.5 by 11 sheet, apparently stuck on some wood panel, that is titled Password Change Sign-Up Sheet. And then the instructions are, if you'd like to change your password, please fill out the form below. And we will change your password on the system you indicate. So, okay, first of all, that's a problem. So, you know, this is public, apparently. It's like, you know, hung next to the coffee machine or the water cooler. And it's got the person's full name, then a column for which system, and that says Yardi, email, etc. And examples are email, phone, and Facebook have been put down in the column. Then the person is giving their current password and then their new password. And in the case of Jack H., who'd like his email password changed,
he's not being very creative.
The current password is reportedly password.
Mm, okay.
And the new password is, I'd like it changed, please, to password 2.
Really upped the security with that one.
Yeah. And Liz wants her phone password changed. Currently, it's 89621, which suspiciously looks like maybe her zip code. But anyway, she wants it changed to something simpler, apparently, just 4281. And we've got, I don't know, what, Kyle, the current password looks like Skooker or Scooter. $49. So that showed some originality. Mm-hmm. He's wanting it to be changed to Skeeker 442. And then he says, parens, all uppercase.
Please.
Even
yes.
though he didn't write it in uppercase. Anyway, so we don't know what the hell is going on here. But
I think it's a joke because you notice that Sam Adams, whose password he wants it to be Beer Lover 1981. I'm thinking it's
okay.
A little bit of a joke. But you know what? It could be real too. This would be a security scorecard of an F for sure.
Well, yeah. And then what happened was Sean decided, I don't know what it was, but he wrote, come see me on a Post-it note.
Side
Sean.
Yeah.
And it may have been the Sam Adams, because that's the last entry in the list of 5.
Yeah.
So maybe Sean thought, okay, wait, you know, maybe this was not such a good idea. Anyway, but obviously the point is, well, everybody gets the point. This is just lunacy. But anyway, if for nothing else, a fun picture of the week for the podcast. This is August 11th, making it August's Patch Tuesday. And Patch Tuesdays have become so eventful, which is really not the word you want associated with patching your computer. But they have become so eventful that we now talk about them on the Tuesday following the Patch Tuesday so we can discuss the events. Woody Leonard, who is a well-known, longtime PC personality, he writes his column for Computer World. He tweeted from @AskWoody, MS DEF CON 2. He said, Patch Tuesdays tomorrow. Take a minute to make sure you have automatic update paused. You have to get patched sooner or later, but there's no reason to join the ranks of the unpaid beta testers, which is pretty much the position he has taken recently. So we'll cover all the details and now, sadly, the inevitable fallout of what happens today, next week. And speaking of weeks, we have last week, which was August 1st through 6th, was the first virtual Black Hat event. I looked through all of the disclosures. Many of them are sort of special interest or maybe somewhat secure, but their titles, if nothing else, are quite titillating. I noticed that many of the issues are things we've already covered in previous weeks or in some cases months, where I noted that this would then be discussed at the forthcoming Black Hat, which was last week. And indeed, it was. And there were some interesting things, but nothing like really jumped out at me. I created one of my little shortcuts because it takes a bit of navigating to get there. So if anyone is curious, just to scan the list of presentations, grc.sc/BH. Again, grc.sc for shortcut /BH. That will take you to the list of the recent Black Hat presentation list. And if you click on any one presentation, you might see something that you want more information about. You'll find a summary of the presentation at some length, and then typically links to the presentation's slides, often an accompanied detailed white paper that can be downloaded. And that's the kind of thing we normally discuss in detail, sometimes months in advance of the actual presentation. And in some cases, even an accompanying software tool that can be downloaded to demonstrate whatever the presenter has, typically hosted over on GitHub. So anyway, a little bit of a self-serve Black Hat because – you know, it was virtual. Everything is online. Nothing really jumped out at me. I looked through everything. And it may be that we end up covering something that ends up to, be more than it looks like.
You're going to cover Achilles, right? I mean, that seemed like a serious. Maybe not.
I'm not even sure what you're referring to.
That's a vulnerability that affects 40% of all Android phones.
Ah, I did see that and did not dig into it.
Yeah, I think that one's
the Snapdragon vulnerability.
Yeah, big Qualcomm Snapdragon vulnerability. And, a billion phones. The problem is most of those phones are older, so they won't be patched.
They're never going to get patched.
Yep. There is a patch, but they're not going to get it.
Yeah, which unfortunately is the refrain these days, which, as we know, for our listeners, for what it's worth, we talk about, absolutely looking at the patching reputation of anyone from whom you purchase a smartphone, because it's a computer in your pocket just as much as our desktops and laptops and workstations are computers.
Yeah, I mean, Samsung just announced its new Samsung Galaxy Note 20, and said, hey, good news, 3 years of updates. And I'm thinking, that's all? But that's pretty typical in the phone space.
And that's a problem because on one hand, it would be nice if they were committing to updates for as long for the service life of the device. On the other hand, you can understand, much like Windows, who finally like Microsoft, that finally decided to kill off, you know, explicitly kill off support for previous versions completely. And although, you know, you have to look at what has happened to Windows 10, you know, and now it's just a continuous rolling new version of Windows 10. So it's not clear that anything changed there. But, you know, what has changed is they are forcing you to move forward rather than allowing you to stay with an older version for you know, an indeterminate length of time. Yeah. So the Graz University gang are at it again. Their most recent paper is titled Speculative Dereferencing of Registers, and they said Reviving Foreshadow. I've got a link to the paper in the show notes, but I'll summarize it for people because there's nothing we as individuals are able to do about this. In their paper, they clearly demonstrate that without a carefully conducted, purely academic understanding of the impact of modern processor design optimizations, which hadn't happened until now, it's not possible to make those designs truly secure. They show that the actual fundamental root cause underlying many of the previously disclosed speculative execution attacks, such as Meltdown and Foreshadow, was misattributed to the effect of prefetching. And this misapprehension resulted in the hardware vendors effectively rushing out and releasing incomplete mitigations and countermeasures for the problem. That is, they didn't actually fix it. So this paper, which is now public, shows that microarchitectural attacks, and you know, we know that to mean attacks affecting the microarchitecture, you know, like the microcode and the things it's doing behind the instruction set, were actually caused by speculative dereferencing of user space registers in the kernel, and that it doesn't only impact the most recent Intel CPUs, which, as we know, have received most of the attention in the last couple of years, including those from Intel carrying the latest hardware mitigations, meaning it still hasn't been fixed, but also several modern processors from ARM, IBM, and AMD, which were previously believed to be immune. So, I mean, this is sweeping impact. So, in other words, by developing, as they have, a true understanding of the problem, they've come up with a new approach to attacking the security guarantees provided by all modern processors. All modern processors.
You know, I bet close attention to this is Apple, since they're in the process of developing new silicon based on the ARM architecture. Just because it's based on it doesn't mean they can do the same thing. I think they would want to kind of eliminate these speculative execution pipelines and things. I don't know.
Yes and no. I'm going to come up with a possibility here at the end of this, because
I want your prescription for what processors should do going forward.
Exactly. So what they said in their abstract is you know, not something we need to deeply understand, but it will give us all a better sense for this. They said in the abstract of the paper, since 2016, multiple microarchitectural attacks have exploited an effect that is attributed to prefetching. These works observe that certain user space operations can fetch kernel addresses into the cache. Fetching user inaccessible data into the cache enables KASLR, we know that that's kernel address space layout randomization, breaks, and assists various meltdown-type attacks, especially foreshadow. In this paper, we provide a systematic analysis of the root cause of this prefetching effect. While we confirm the empirical results of previous papers, we show that the attribution to a prefetching mechanism is fundamentally incorrect in all previous papers describing or exploiting this effect. In particular, neither the prefetch instruction nor other user space instructions actually prefetch kernel addresses into the cache, leading to incorrect conclusions and ineffectiveness of proposed defenses. The effect exploited in all these papers is, in fact, caused by speculative dereferencing of user space registers in the kernel. Hence, mitigation techniques such as Kaiser, which is the solution in Linux, do not eliminate this leakage as previously believed. Beyond our thorough analysis of these previous works, we also demonstrate new attacks enabled by understanding the root cause, namely an address translation attack in more restricted contexts, direct leakage of register values in certain scenarios, and the first end-to-end foreshadow exploit targeting non-L1 cache data. The latter is effective even with the recommended foreshadow mitigations enabled and thus revives the foreshadow attack. And they conclude, we demonstrate that these dereferencing effects exist even on the most recent Intel CPUs with the latest hardware mitigations and on CPUs previously believed to be unaffected, i.e. ARM, IBM, and AMD CPUs. So what does this translate for us in the real world? The researchers established a cache-based covert channel, as they described it, that was able, they demonstrated it, able to exfiltrate data from a process running on an Intel Core i7-6500 CPU to their stealth process, achieving a transmission rate of 10 bits per second and relaying a total of 128 bytes from the sender process to the receiver. Now, as we know, we're not looking at attacks any longer that like export the whole process space. That's not necessary because typically what you want are keys. 128 bytes, which they were able to pull out at 10 bits per second, is the length of four 256-bit cryptographic secrets. So if you can steal the keys, you pretty much got the kingdom. They also worked out a means of leaking the register contents from an Intel SGX enclave, extracting a 32-bit secret value stored in the enclave in a 64-bit register within 15 minutes. And to give their research a bit more bite, they also demonstrated some of their attacks can be performed at a distance using JavaScript combined with WebAssembly. So this is mostly to get the attention of the people for whom it matters, which are the chip vendors and the OS vendors. There's nothing that we as end users need to or can do about any of this. You know, in this, we're all spectators. The only full and true solution requires our processors to even further back away from their dearly beloved performance enhancements. And Leo, to your point, it may be that someday we'll be given a choice between performance
and security
and reduced security.
Wow.
Yes. or full security with a performance compromise. And you know, as we've talked about this, when we talked about Spectre and Meltdown and so forth, and how, well, first of all, this is all theoretical. There hasn't been a single attack that's ever been demonstrated practically or in the wild. It's just been security researchers saying, yeah, but we could. And the environment matters. I would argue it would make sense for unshared personal PCs to opt for performance, whereas cloud-based systems where they have a shared infrastructure and they're also super beefy machines, they would probably have to take the enforced security route. And, you know, this might be something you set in hardware, like a jumper on your motherboard. So it's not even a BIOS thing that could be changed because that's too soft. Maybe it's a different processor where Intel says, well, we'll sell you this speedy one that's got all of the triple scoop enhancements that we know how to do, but unfortunately, it's got Spectre, it's got Meltdown, it's got Foreshadow, it's vulnerable to all this. But who cares? If it's your computer, you know, your different processes are the only things running on it. And, you know, if something gets into your computer, then, you know, doing some really bleeding edge Spectre thing is not what any malware is going to do. It's going to encrypt your hard drive, or it's going to, you know, do something sort of blatantly nefarious, not try to leverage some very subtle cross thread or cross core cache leakage. It's just not going to. But in the meantime, since you're not worrying about all that, you get top line performance from this processor. Or if you do have an environment where security is more important than performance. And by that, I mean this kind of like, okay, it's probably never, ever going to bite you kind of security, except you have to be able to say we've chosen the Intel, you know, Secure Core system. Yes, at, you know, 2/3 the performance. Because we've had to disable all this stuff that the academicians have demonstrated could provide leakage, but it's secure. Certainly, there's a market for that. So, I mean, I could see it having it going both ways. It's what this comes down to clearly is that there, in order to optimize the operation of our systems, we must have caching, and we must speculate. We've got to load pipelines with both outcomes of a branch, so that regardless of which way the branch goes, we're already starting to execute down both paths, because that's the way we get state-of-the-art performance. Is, you know, it's not the road less taken, it's both roads taken, and then we decide which outcome we want as soon as we figure out what the result of an earlier branch was. We have, I mean, insane as that technology is, Intel has implemented it, and that's the way we got the performance that has spoiled us. But that inherently means that there will be there will be traces of those decisions left behind when execution is suddenly changed to a different process, and that's the way we do multiprocessing these days. Now, maybe that could change so that instead of it just being a timer event which ticks and then suddenly a thread context is changed, maybe the solution is for the OS and the processor to agree on when it is safe to make a context switch. So maybe we need to rethink the way we share a set of cores among a much larger set of processes and OS instances or VMs. You know, maybe that's the route we'll take. You know, some sort of a flushing or a safe to switch boundary, or it may be that you use lower performance systems if you really, really want to say, you know, even the academicians are finally happy, even if we need to add a few more processors to the system in order to get the same level of performance. Anyway, the guys at Graz did it again. It looks like this time they really cut it down to the bone, understood the nature of the problem, and this really leaves us with a choice.
Is it's inherent in all modern architectures that we have to do prefetching, or is it conceivable that there could be optimizations that aren't susceptible to this kind of?
So the way the Intel does the Intel architecture and all the others do their paging, this mapping between virtual memory and physical memory, it really is insane. It's like a four layers of indirection with these paging tables, which technically are in RAM, but if you actually had to go get them from RAM, it would take you a year to boot your machine. I mean, it because you can't be going to get them from RAM. So they have to bring them into the hardware in order to make the lookup fast. And even then, they cache the result of the four-way page table lookup. So they only have to do that when they don't have a result from the most, you know, a recently immediately previous lookup, because that's the only way to make this system work.
So what
even
about
that
Optane
can be
or some sort
a source
faster
of compromise.
RAM or RAM that's closer to the CPU or I mean
yes and that's what's interesting. Remember that all of this is a consequence of the fact that DRAM, just which is based on a large sheet of capacitors, just it has proven absolutely intractable for getting any speed increase. Our processors have just shot ahead of where DRAM remains.
Interesting.
But there is that what is that
Crossfire,
the Intel Crosspoint.
That's Optane now. That's the brand name.
The Optane memory is interesting because although there's some concern about fatigue, it is at least dramatically faster.
Right.
And so, if Optane gets built onto the chip, then maybe this can push this caching problem further down. But also even up at the higher level, technically, speculation is caching, right? Because we're pre-executing multiple paths and caching the outcome, so that once a branch, whose outcome we've been waiting for, is determined, the processor's already gone down both paths and has got our results waiting for us. So there are, I mean, it just turns out to be like all the clever things that designers have come up with leaves a trace in down in the microarchitecture. And the security researchers said, you know, you just can't do that. We can sense that. And that allows us to determine what another process was doing when context switched to us. So I think some level of rethinking maybe of the way processes and or virtual machines share the processor is going to be necessary.
Remember one of those attacks?
There was a really cool one of the Rowhammer attacks used the fact that you could have many more instances of Linux sharing a single hardware platform because they were all running Linux, and that meant they all had a copy of the same OS, which meant that the virtual machine manager was clever enough to point all of these separate VMs to the same physical memory,
right?
Instead of them each actually having what looks like a copy of their own physical memory. In other words, they were doing page table collapsing,
right,
where they were actually all sharing this. I mean, it's very clever.
It's my understanding that's how containerization works as well. And you know, the world is moving towards containerization like Docker. That's one of the benefits of it, is that you can share the OS space. So,
right.
Boy, I am. We clearly went down a wrong path. You think these guys
nice
are right?
While, I mean,
these guys, yeah, it was good because it lasted. It's probably prudent at this point to reiterate that this only affects people with shared processes on the same processor, multiple different users with the same, because one of them could be malicious and could see in theory what you're doing in your process. So that's why it's a server issue more, or a virtual private server issue. That more than it is a individual computing issue. But, you know, honestly, the future, in my opinion, is that we won't need such processors on our desktop because we'll have server processors. That's what this all this cloud gaming is. And this could be a big dent in that possible future. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's got to be a way around it. They don't have to do speculative execution. Right? Surely there's somebody, some bright guy is going to come along and say, oh, well, what if you did this? And then in 10 years, we'll be talking about the next
thing. There is the possibility. It all comes down to the problem with the go-to instruction. And if you change things around so that you had the come from, then that would really...
I told you, you guys should have used Lisp. I've been telling you this. You and your go-tos. It's really an interesting conundrum. And this is these guys are reliable, right? These are the guys who came up with the initial research.
I mean, they are, you know, they made their thesis advisors very happy with this one.
Yes. Wow. That's a big story. That really is a big story. Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. And the fact that it's not some mistake Intel made.
No, everybody
made
it.
Fundamental.
Yeah. Well, and they didn't make a mistake. It was a choice that turns out to have unfortunate consequences.
Yeah, and this goes deep. You know, remember that we talked about how someone a while back did comment that, well, you know, if you do this speculation, then there could be some cross-process leakage of information.
In 67 or something, or 76, this paper came out. And was the year before they started doing it.
Right.
So it was kind of known there's a potential here.
Yeah.
Maybe we just didn't have the tools to achieve it or something. I don't know. Back to the drawing board. And it ain't going to be Intel.
We do know that there has been an arms race for processor performance.
Right.
And so it's understandable that without this being anyone's fault, really, the engineers did say, oh, wow, you know, we've got so much silicon now, we can, you know, we don't have to wait to see which branch the code takes. We'll just do them both because, you know, why not? And someone said, great idea, go. And, you know, and then so that seemed to be good. You know, it worked. It executed the instructions correctly. And everybody was happy with it for, you know, quite a while.
Yeah.
And then someone said, wait a minute.
And
the music ended, and there were a lot of people standing and not many chairs.
Where's the chairs? Where'd the chairs go?
Yeah.
It was 1995. Somebody wrote this paper saying, you could have a problem with this. The Intel x86 processor architecture pitfalls for a secure systems.
Yep.
1995 IEEE symposium warned against a covert timing channel in the CPU cache and translation look-aside buffer.
This was under the auspices of the NSA, which said, shh, ixnay on the security issue. Let it be that we know, but no one else does. What do you say? Wow. The NSA. Wow. It's been going on for a while.
So one quickie, and then we'll take our second break, because this is not big. We can add Canon, you know, Canon Corporation, to the growing list of large, high-profile companies who have a lot to lose, who have recently had their security compromised by a quite public ransomware attack.
Gosh darn it.
Bleeping Computer was all over this one, and as they did with Garmin, they solicited and were able to obtain some previously unpublished internal memos in advance of any Canon official disclosure. As we know, Canon's many services dropped offline on Thursday, July 30th, and remained down until they began returning to use 6 days later, a week ago, last Tuesday, the 4th. An internal message, so this is what a copy of what Bleeping Computer got. It's titled, Internal Message from the Crisis Management Committee. Canon USA, Inc. and its subsidiaries understand the importance of maintaining the operational integrity and security of our systems. Access to some Canon systems is currently unavailable as a result of a ransomware security incident we recently discovered. This is unrelated to the recent issue which affected Image.Canon.
Oh, I thought it was the same thing.
I know.
Oh.
That's what they're saying. It's odd that the timing was
what it was. People were furious about Image.Canon. They lost a lot of originals.
Yes. They said, we immediately implemented our response protocols and began an investigation. Cybersecurity experts who have worked with other companies that have had similar issues have been engaged. We are working quickly to address the issue and to restore operations. As updates are available, we will do our best to communicate via email and ENS, whatever that is. We appreciate your patience as we work through this incident.
If I were Canon, I would blame the Image.Canon loss on this. Because what they're saying is, oh, no, it had nothing to do with that. We just made a mistake in the code, and that's why we lost all your images.
Oh.
I would have said, it could have. It could be the ransomware. Definitely.
It's the bad guys. It's the bad guys.
Oh, by the way, Canon said today, you ain't getting those images back. They're gone.
Oh, boy.
Oh, I hope you didn't, folks, I hope none of you used it as your only backup. Remember what Leo says, and Steve, too. One copy anything is not a backup.
That was 10 gigabytes of free image upload and storage.
Gone.
Yeah. So we don't know anything about the way they got back online, how it was resolved, whether a ransom was paid or not, blah, blah, blah. Bleeping Computer did identify this, however, as the Maze ransomware. So different than the one that zapped Garmin. But still, you know, this has got to be the issue that keeps companies and IT people up at night. At this point, you know, how many times have we said it? I understand the challenge when, as Garmin did, you have 30,000 workstations and this thing rifles through them and gets to them. That's going to be tough to bring back online. But unfortunately, that's the price of playing the game these days. Wow. Leo, we will talk about a very sad event and disclosure with VB Bulletin after our second break.
Wow. What a world we live in. Huh? What was it? Now they're saying Garmin's paid $10 million to get their data back.
Well, that was the asking price.
They negotiated it down?
They could have. There was a similar incident where the $10 million was asking, and they ended up paying 4.5, I think it was. So, still, you know, it's like for a company like Garmin, if they really didn't have backups, and of course the other problem now is exfiltration. You know, the embarrassment of because that's now you know it's okay. You may decide not to pay us, but we're going to just post all of your secrets.
That's why they get on the system and they exfiltrate for 3 months and then they ransomware.
Yep.
Oh, good. It's the worst thing that could happen. Yeah, let's take a break. I want to talk about privacy.com. We talked about this many times before. This is the credit card I use anytime I buy online, every single time. They're virtual cards, one-time use cards or locked to the merchant cards. I completely control. We had a caller on the radio show on Friday or Saturday. Maybe it was Sunday. Anyway, who said, I think it was Saturday. He said, all five of my credit cards were compromised yesterday. I said, what? How could that be? Did you store them all in one place? He said, I think they were all on Amazon. He said, yeah. So my advice, and I did tell him this, get privacy.com. First, stop storing all credit cards on any one service, no more than one at a time, please, in case that service is breached. Save yourself some trouble. Better yet, use privacy.com. And then those credit cards are good nowhere else, or they're only good for that one-time use. You don't use the same password at every site. We know that's a bad idea. That's what you're doing when you use the same credit card at every site. Privacy.com gives you a brand new virtual Visa or MasterCard number for every purchase you make online. Now, I use it. I have the Chrome. There's a Chrome extension. I use it on Firefox. They have an Android and iOS app. You can link your virtual cards to either a checking account or a debit card. It's up to you. But that's an important point. It's not a charge card. It's like a debit card. But you have complete control of it. For instance, I never sign up these days for a subscription anything without using a privacy.com card because it's something, you know, you forget. It's hard to remember. It's hard to cancel. No problem. I just pause the card, and I love getting the notes. Hey, your card didn't work. Yeah, and it's not going to work, buddy. You can pause or you can delete it, but I like to pause it. That way I can bring it back if I want. You could set a spending limit on every card or every transaction. So you say, look, I never want to spend more than $5 a month or a transaction on this card. You can tie the card to an individual merchant. It's a great way to control recurring payments, subscription payments, online payments of any kind. You never have to worry about forgetting to cancel your subscriptions or free trials ever again. You will never be billed twice or upgraded without your consent. Privacy always sends me notices about declines. You could have it as a text message. You could have it as an email. You could have it as a notification on the screen. They have a new feature called card sharing, which is so great. You can safely and securely send somebody a privacy card from your dashboard. I do this all the time. When my mom, for instance, I like to buy her dinner. So I say, Mom, here's a card you can use for your DoorDash. And don't try to use it anywhere else because it won't work anywhere else. Once DoorDash uses it, it's locked to them. Feel free to use it anytime. I see every time she uses it, if it's ever compromised, I'll know immediately when I see the decline. You don't have to copy into a text message that's insecure, a paste or a screenshot. And by the way, Mom does not need a privacy account to use it. It's just a credit card number. Click the share button when you're viewing a card, enter an email address, and privacy handles the rest. It's just like a credit card or a debit card. It's PCI DSS compliant, same security standards as your bank. They encrypt everything. Actually, it's good for your privacy. The sensitive information is secured using military-grade encryption. So, in fact, they do something really cool. They use split key encryption, partial keys held by separate employees. No one employee has the whole key, so no one person can access the info on the server. It's like the sending off the rockets on the mountain. You got to turn both keys. Privacy never sells your data. Your information is safe with them. And the merchant doesn't necessarily get it either because privacy has it set up in such a way that you can use a fake address, fake zip code, even a fake name. So you really have privacy when you're using your privacy card. It's so cool. You know, you could say John Doe, 123 Main Street, Anytown, USA, 000000. Privacy will approve it because they see you do need the card, obviously, expiration date and the security number, and they'll approve it because they want to allow you to keep your information private. But from the point of view of the merchant, it's a standard Visa or MasterCard. Now, they have three different ways to go on this. There's a free plan. You can do up to 12 cards a month. For most people, that's plenty. And you can do either secure merchant locked or single-use cards. Or you can do a paid version. There's Pro and Teams. I do the Pro version, which is $10 a month, but it pays for itself because you also, with the Pro version, get 1% cash back. You get additional security features, too. So 1% cash back, I use privacy so much, I actually get more money back than I pay for the Pro version. So that makes sense for me. Teams is great, too, if you've got a business and you want multiple team members to have their own credit cards. Privacy, just, this is brand new since last we talked, have launched a card-issuing API. So this is interesting, and I wouldn't have any use for this, but it was built for developers and small business owners who want to create cards at scale. So you could use the privacy interface, the API, have a custom app. You know, if it sounds like it could fit, you check out privacy. You could talk to them about the API. Honestly, I never use a credit card online anymore. I use my privacy.com account. Privacy.com/securitynow. Sign up for an account. We're going to automatically, just as a treat, thanks you for using our special URL, give you $5 to spend on your first purchase. Limited time. Free money. Privacy.com/securitynow. We want to do that because we want you to use that. That way they know you saw it here, and that's important to us. Privacy.com/securitynow to sign up. Now, I really love what they do, and it's a great service, and I've used it for years, long before they were a sponsor. In fact, I think the reason they're a sponsor is because I begged and pleaded with them. I said, Steve and I want to tell the world about how to use. And it used to be other companies would do this. Discover used to do, you know, a one-time. It wasn't as good, but at least you could make up a one-time credit card. A lot of them don't do that anymore.
Yep.
Privacy is the best way to do it. Privacy.com/securitynow. Steve?
Yep. I recommended, as I mentioned to you before the show, I recommended them to actually my best friend.
Well, I told this guy who lost 5 credit cards in one day, I said, you should really be using this from now on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So this story begins just 2 days ago on Sunday, August 9th, with a posting by a security researcher who goes by the name Amir Etemade, and his Twitter handle is at Xenoflex. He maintains a blog at exploiteers, exploiteers.rs, so sort of exploiters. And to give you some feel for his approach, his recent postings have been titled Rooting the Fire TV Cube and Pendant with Fire FU, All Your Things Are Belong to Us, Hacking the Western Digital MyCloud NAS, Network Attached Storage, Rehacking the Samsung Smart Cam. So this guy clearly likes poking at things and documenting his discoveries. He's also currently looking for a job. He recently posted a pinned tweet addressed to Twitter stating on July 6th, Hey Twitter, I'm actively looking for a job. An ideal role would include full-time exploit dev, he says, parens remote, with great benefits. I have crashes, fuzzers, and a good 0 day. If you have an opening that you think I may be a good fit for, contact me, Xenoflex at, and then http://xenoflex.com. Now, unfortunately, he followed up that job solicitation by Sunday, irresponsibly posting his discovery and full details of a true 0 day exploit, a remote code execution exploit against vBulletin without ever giving them a heads up. You know, I'm not Twitter.
Oh, that's too bad. Clearly,
I know. He's clearly a talented reverse engineer, and I'm sure he understands what he has just done, and somehow he doesn't care. But I would not want this person inside my company. So, you know, they say that when you apply for a job these days, the content of your social media is typically scrutinized. Well, were I considering someone to hire, it wouldn't be someone who is, you know, essentially boasting about a critical remote code execution vulnerability, posting full details in multiple languages, even a slide deck, you know, about it. and saying, you know, good luck. So this particularly explosive security bomb he titled Exploiting vBulletin, A Tale of a Patch Fail. And he wrote, he said, on September 23rd, so September 23rd, 2019, right, like almost a year ago, an undisclosed researcher released a bug which allowed for PHP remote code execution in vBulletin 5.0 through 5.4. This bug, CVE-2019-16759, was labeled a bug door by a popular vulnerability broker because of its simplicity and was marked with a CVSS score of 9.8, you know, 10 being the maximum. Yeah.
That's not good.
he writes, today, we're going to talk about how the patch that was supplied for the vulnerability was inadequate in blocking exploitation, show how to bypass the resulting fix, and release a bash one-liner resulting in remote code execution in the latest vBulletin software. He says the vulnerability mentioned above was formally labeled CVE-2019-16759, and a patch was issued, blah, blah, blah. So that kind of repeats things. He says, although the patch was provided in under 3 days, the patch seemed at the time to fix the proof of concept exploit provided. In other words, vBulletin immediately responded and had it patched in under 3 days. Okay, then Amir proceeds to take this apart, this previous work, step by step. And like Sandbox Escaper, he's clearly a skilled technician. His posting beautifully walks its reader through the way vBulletin's on-the-fly PHP authoring engine operates, and he provides a proof of concept, and not just one. He first offers a single curl command line and provides a bash script he promised. He also shows a Python exploit and indicates that he's in the process of pushing a public Metasploit module. He even produced and published a deck, as I mentioned, a PowerPoint slides, a link for which I have in the show notes. He then concludes by offering what he describes as a short-term fix. He says at the end of his posting, this fix will disable PHP widgets within your forums and may break some functionality. He doesn't say so, but ads do break. But will keep you safe from attacks until a patch is released by vBulletin, whom he did not inform of this. So you go to vBulletin Administrator Control Panel, click Settings in the menu on the left, then Options in the dropdown, choose General Settings, and then click Edit Settings. Look for Disable PHP, Static HTML, and Add Module Rendering. Set to Yes, click Save. So what happened next? Unfortunately, vBulletin sites are easy to locate with any Google search for the phrase powered by vBulletin. And vBulletin is one of the more popular forum software systems. It is in use by Electronic Arts, Zynga, Sony, Pearl Jam, NASA, Steam, and many more. The attacks started almost immediately upon his publication. Jeff Moss, who's known as the Dark Tangent, perhaps best known as the creator of the Black Hat and DEF CON security conferences, tweeted, a new vBulletin 0 day got dropped yesterday by Xenoflex that revealed the CVE-2019-16759 patch was incomplete. Within 3 hours, forum.defcon.org was attacked. He says, but we were ready for it, whatever that means. He says, disable PHP rendering to protect yourself until patched! Amir's reply to Jeff was, thanks for the mention. Though I'm sure Jeff would have preferred not to have his defcon.org site attacked if this had been done responsibly. And around the same time, Amir tweeted, looks like the at vBulletin forums are currently down while they patch from the RCE vulnerability release. Hopefully that means customers will also see a working patch soon. Yeah, gee. Or instead of being attacked by an irresponsibly disclosed zero day, customers would probably have much preferred that he disclose this quietly to vBulletin, who would certainly have taken it very seriously. Last September's publication of the original zero day, the fix for which I mentioned, or the fix for which this is a workaround, triggered a massive wave of vBulletin hacks, which resulted in many companies disclosing security breaches through the months that followed. Since Amir did disclose this vulnerability, it's clear that he didn't want to use it himself. But the disconnect here seems to be that he won't mind at all if he enables, directly enables, others to wreak havoc in his name. And sure enough, yesterday we have a thread on the vBulletin support forum. The first one I found this morning, I received the scan results on my server that shows a URL known exploit fingerprint match PHP shell exploit, indicating I have some type of issue. It was recommended that I replace the web.php file, which, by the way, is not an official file on vBulletin. That's something that somebody installed and then ran. That is fine, but I don't know what this file does or where another copy of it would be. Yesterday at 7:27 a.m., my site was also compromised this morning at 6:35 a.m. GMT-7. The file is named 1.php and was placed in the root of the site. Windows Defender identified the exploit as backdoor phpshell.q. I've zipped up the file and attached here as backdoor. Yesterday, 11:15 a.m., I got hacked at noon. Central Standard Time today was on 5.6.1 patch level 1. Have upgraded to 5.6.2. Can provide HTTP access and error logs to Wayne Luke if you guys need help determining the attack vendor. Wayne works for support at vBulletin. At 11:25 a.m., we know the vector and a patch is being developed. Hopefully, I can say more soon. The only workaround I can say at this time is to make your vBulletin directory read-only, chmod444. And, of course, that relates to we were talking about Linux directory privileges. Turns out that remediation was found not to work because it blocked some access that was needed to the .ht access file. Yesterday at 11:44 a.m., I found the files hacks.php at these locations and then two URLs. Yesterday at 12:20 p.m., my 5.6.1 site was hit and I cannot access either URL. I have 444'd it. He says my 5.6.2 sites appear unaffected. Yesterday at 12:57 p.m., hi, is this the best place to be kept up to date about this issue? Our 5.6.2 forum was hit as well today. Is there a CVE number to track the issues yet? And then finally, yesterday at 2:06 p.m., patches are available and a link to the patches. So, you know, this is not just theoretical. When you loudly disclose a simple to execute remote code execution vulnerability like this, it hurts people. I mean, it messes things up for people. And so I'm at a loss to understand, like, what's in the mind of a person, especially who says, hey, Twitter, how'd you like to hire me? Right. Like, Twitter's in the mood for that right now after what they've just gone through. So, you know, needless to say, anyone using version 5 of vBulletin, that needs to have been patched last Sunday, 2 days ago. Patch it now if it hasn't been.
Wow.
And, you know, to the common refrain that it's crucial to keep lines of communication open to the vendors of the software you're using. In other words, you'd like to have received this notice from vBulletin yesterday. I'll now add that this reality suggests that some level of compromise needs to be factored into any security-conscious organization. You know, it's similar to the fact that intrusion detection has now become an accepted part of an overall security posture. Detecting an intrusion, you know, by preparing for it, inherently acknowledges that there's going to be or might be an intruder to detect. And that's never good. But if there's going to be an intruder to detect, it's far better that it be detected than not. We know that the proper way to think about security is that it is inherently porous. I hate the truth of that, but we see it over and over and over. You know, the adjective porous is the one I've adopted and used on the podcast because I think it perfectly says that, you know, the more pressure you put against security, the more likely it is that something will leak through. You know, it's not absolute. The sobering truth is that this means that systems must be made less brittle. By that, I mean that the event of a security breach should bend but not break an organization's security. A practical example of this might be to recognize that PHP-based forum software has grown quite complex. And we all know what that means. With complexity comes risk. So, to mitigate the risk, software like PHP-based forums should be run on their own hardware behind a firewall, such that even gaining root access on that machine, that firewall cannot be bypassed. So not just a firewall running on the machine, but a firewall outside of that machine. The typical forum only needs to have access to an organization's DNS and email servers. I would argue that it should have its own local SQL database and not be reaching outside to the organization's shared SQL server. There's a recipe for, as an example, a recipe for disaster. Containment in the event of a breach is the whole point. And since DNS and email services exist at fixed addresses and only need a couple of ports, and they're comparatively benign if they've been set up right, a forum hosting machine's network connection should be placed behind a deny any external firewall that only makes exceptions to that deny any policy for a very few ports. After all, this is the reason we call a firewall a firewall. If anything catches fire and explodes on that machine, which in this case might be inevitable, if it's hosting complex PHP-based forum software, at least the damage will be contained. So, in other words, you know, think about what if, you know, pose what if scenarios and then ask where you can impose boundaries of containment so that your overall corporate security posture is flexible. If something happens, okay, ouch, but it's, you know, it didn't let somebody get out of a PHP forum onto your network, you know, execute code, get onto your network, and then, you know, set up a much more potent advanced persistent threat by then putting files up on a shared SQL server and, you know, going from there. The world we live in today. As for the world we don't yet live in today, DOH for Windows 10. You know, we don't talk much about fast ring and slow ring or the release preview ring because even being on the how do I get off this roller coaster ring provides sufficient excitement these days. for on Windows 10. But those rings fascinate Paul and especially Mary Jo, who talk about them all the time over on Windows Weekly. And while we're on the subject of rings, I'll note that the paint is still wet on the renaming of those rings to now refer to them as channels. That's the official new designation. In order of decreasing excitement and increasing sanity and stability, we have the dev channel, the beta channel, and the release preview channel. Rings are gone. We have channels now. So as we know, and we talked about it in November, way back in November of 2018, Microsoft surprised us by announcing that Windows 10 would natively be getting encrypted DNS using DOH, DNS over HTTPS. Apparently not DOT, but that's the way they, I mean, so they're like going the way everybody else has. So that would mean that not just random browsers running on Windows, but everything in the OS would get its DNS lookups encrypted. This will actually happen for the first time when the dev channel, previously known as the dev ring, now the dev channel, gets the Windows 10 Insider Preview Build 20185, which is coming soon to a dev channel near you if you like to live dangerously. And as I said before, this early access news doesn't move me at all, since I'm definitely happy staying right where I am, getting actual work done over in the "won't you just please stop fussing with it" channel. But once this does migrate to the regular, okay, we're going to get this in an update through Windows 10 for the rest of us, we'll definitely be talking about it, since its configuration details will probably be interesting. And I'm sure that a bunch of our listeners will have applications where it makes sense for their DNS to stay away from prying eyes. You know, I'm on a Cox cable connection. Cox sees my lookups, but then they all go everywhere else from Cox's servers, and I have nothing of interest to Cox, so I'm not that worried about it. But certainly, I get it that a lot of people will be. This is a really interesting story about Troy Hunt, and it's too long for me to cover in the kind of detail that I wanted to, but I'll give you enough of a taste of it, I hope, to whet your appetite, because I gave the longest part of the story another shortcut, so that to encourage people to go find it. I titled this "Hasn't Been Pwned," because without success, it turns out that Troy Hunt has just concluded a year-long search for someone to purchase or maybe merge with his very popular and very useful Have I Been Pwned site. Have I Been Pwned is really a much bigger deal than it might seem from the outside. For example, in his posting of March this year, following 10 months of work to find a partner, he said, "A lot happens in 11 months. I onboarded 5 new governments onto HIBP, Austria, Ireland, Norway, Switzerland, and Denmark." He says, "And a 6th one about to be announced any day now. I loaded 77 new data breaches comprising 1.7 billion records into Have I Been Pwned, and signed up almost 400,000 more individual subscribers to the service." Holy crap. He says, "I built and launched the authenticated API and payment process. I really should have done this earlier. I'm so happy with it." So, yeah, there's a lot there. As I said, he posted the story of his 11th month quest back in March. It is really and truly a fantastic read. He describes the insanity of endless meetings and notes the process's bizarre similarity to many of our much-loved episodes of Silicon Valley. And he, like, you know, really talks about it in some detail. There were hundreds of initial candidates, which he went through a screening process and a successive weaning process over, with NDAs and due diligences and all kinds of stuff. And if we didn't have way too much else to get to, I would read it into the podcast. But since I really believe it's worthwhile, I've given it, as I said, a GRC shortcut, grc.sc/Troy, T-R-O-Y. You really should check it out if you have a chance, grc.sc/Troy. I think all of our listeners would find it really interesting. So that was as of March of this year. Troy began the wrap-up of that post by writing, "So, what's next for HIBP and for me?" He says, "To be honest, I need time to recover. What I've explained in this post will never adequately illustrate just how stressful this process was. I need some time where I'm not waking up dreading how much work will have landed in my inbox overnight. I need some time to write more code and more blog posts, two things that remain my passion, but had to take a back seat during this process. I'll still keep running, have I been pwned, as I always have, but I need the headspace to get my energy levels back up and plan the next phase." He says, "I've almost entirely cleared my calendar for the next few months," and consider that this was in March of this year, so we know what was going on in March, "to give me that much needed timeout. And with coronavirus causing a heap of conferences to be canceled and travel plans to be disrupted, it's probably not a bad time to stay home anyway." And that brings us to today and Troy's posting just last Friday. I have a link to the blog, most recent blog posting, and he starts out, "Let me just cut straight to it. I'm going to open source the Have I Been Pwned code base. The decision has been a while coming, and it took a failed M&A process," that's what he called his mergers and acquisition process, "to get here. But the code will be turned over to the public for the betterment of the project, and frankly, for the betterment of everyone who uses it. Let me explain why and how." And he goes on. And again, it's useful to read that. I've got a link in the show notes. And I'm struck again, wishing I could share his detailed description of his plans for Have I Been Pwned. But at least the gist of it is clear. Have I Been Pwned will become a major and significant open source project on GitHub, so that Troy is no longer carrying the entire burden of moving it forward himself. It's clear that there's huge enthusiasm for the features offered by the system, and Troy's approach has always been to be entirely open and transparent anyway. So, I mean, it just seems like a good fit and the natural next step. We'll certainly be keeping an eye on it. So the news here is Have I Been Pwned is going to GitHub and open source, and will be open to contributions and code from people other than just Troy himself. A couple little bits of miscellany. I did have an opportunity to try Bloatbox, which was that GitHub-hosted Windows 10 debloating software that I had referred to before, and it again unimpresses. I have not yet found any app for debloating Windows 10 that does the job. And I'm still refusing to be dissuaded distracted from SpinWrite. Nothing is pulling me from that. Other people can write a Windows 10 debloater. It doesn't need me. So I will keep looking for someone to point me to one and one that I can recommend. But we still don't have it. the security now shortcut of the week. I've already talked about a couple shortcuts I assigned to specific things. This is the shortcut of the week. So it's numbered this podcast, grc.sc/779. It will take you to a page on Bleeping Computer, which I just sort of thought was worth sharing, mostly for the last of the seven. It's titled Useful Registry Hacks to Optimize Your Windows 10 Experience. The first one is disabling Bing search in Windows search. It says Windows search comes with a Bing search engine integration, and it allows you to find the content on Bing when the local search fails to find anything. If you don't like Bing due to privacy or performance issues, or if it's causing problems, you can disable it via the registry. And so Bleeping Computers has a link to show you how. Also, disabling the Windows 10 lock screen is the second one. Number three, add open command window here to the File Explorer context menu. I like that, actually. And I've, as a command line user, I've used that extensively in previous versions of Windows. This allows you to get it back if you, too, miss it in Windows 10. If for some reason you wanted to display seconds on the taskbar clock, there's a way to do that. I don't need that, but maybe someone would like it. This one, though, the last one, I thought, that's interesting, just because why not? Enable verbose mode in Windows 10. It reads, with a tweak to the registry, you can boot your Windows 10 PC into verbose mode and get more detailed information and helpful, which is extremely helpful when troubleshooting problems. It explained, this mode will display the specific step the operating system is on while booting up and shutting down Windows 10. This mode allows you to troubleshoot startup and shutdown issues to see the specific steps that are being performed when a problem occurs. And, you know, you get that spinning roller coaster dot thing, and it's like, oh, I would like to know what it's doing. So I turned it on, and it tells you after you make the setting, reboot. I rebooted my Windows 10 machine, my main workstation, and it showed and stalled at stopping a specific service. And sure enough, I had been wondering why my Windows 10 shutdown had been taking so long. It doesn't tell you. It immediately told me that the service that it was stalled on trying to shut down. And I thought, I'm not using that anymore. So I disabled it, and now my Windows 10 shutdown went back to its, you know, normal speed. So just a tip. I really like that one. Again, grc.sc/779 will take you to the Bleeping Computer page with these links. The last one shows you that it's just a registry. You add a D word, set it to one, deep down in some policies somewhere, and now Windows 10 tells you what it's doing, which is like, why not? Also, just a little bit of closing the loop. Someone who calls himself Starkiss tweeted from @StarKiss1. He said, thanks for mentioning QNAP in the last Security Now. Remember, we talked about the horrible problem, 68,000, I think it was, publicly accessible QNAP servers, many of which are insecure and located in the U.S. He says, found that my firmware was greater than 4 revisions out of date. Got absolutely no notifications. Love the podcast. So I'm certainly glad that our mention of this problem with QNAP did reach some people who needed it. And this, again, in this day and age, nothing more important than assuring that you have lines of open communication to the software vendors of all the stuff you use. Alas, a quick little bit on where I am with SpinRite. We're down to the point now of finding and fixing obscure problems. Somebody had a Kingston SSD on an Acer Aspire that was causing problems. I had two SSDs, an OCZ and a something else, that were having problems. It turns out that they did not like transferring 6553 sectors at a time. And it turns out I had discovered this 7 years ago in 2013, written adaptive code for it, and forgotten about it. Although when I discovered it, they would only go up to 65528, that is 8 sectors shy of the maximum. That number was haunting because I thought, I remember something about this. Anyway, it turns out that cutting the transfer in half to 32K sectors and thus 16 megabyte transfers solved the compatibility problems across the board. And because that still takes much longer than it does for me to queue up the next transfer, nothing is lost in performance and we only gain in compatibility. There was somebody else had a drive where it was in really bad shape and it kept basically going offline and losing its link layer connectivity. What was bizarre was it works well, or at least appears to, under Windows. So it wasn't causing any obvious problems, but the benchmark would refuse to complete because the drive was just losing its SATA link. So I ended up, over a course of 3 iterations of test releases, developing a like almost infinite forgivability of this drive. And I said to the guy, I said, look, you got to open your laptop, unplug your SSD and plug it in again because it's got a bad connector, but don't do it until I add software to fix this in software because I want to still be able to run with it the way it is, as bad as it is. And what this means is that SpinRite will be able to notify its users when it detects problems like this, because actually we've run across a few others that are having a similar problem. So it looks like it's somewhat common in SATA connections because they really do. You know, we're talking about, what is it, 6 gigabits per second serial link. So it's a finicky link, and SpinRite will be able to diagnose link problems separate from media-related problems and tell its user, you know, we could run if we really had to, but you really ought to fix the connection to your SSD and then, you know, try again.
That
and
would
we'll
be
let you
so
know
helpful.
If you've got it fixed.
Yeah. So you could tell it's a different signature if it's a bad cable than if it's something wrong with the drive.
Yeah. What actually happens is that there's lots of error bits, and there were like three different error conditions in order to squeeze the data across the serial link. There's actually, you don't put the 8-bit data on the link because the link is self-clocking. And so if you had like 8 bits of zeros, you wouldn't get any clocking information for too long a period of time.
Right.
So the 8 bits are turned into 10 bits.
Right.
And there's a fancy translation table that maps every byte into 10 bits. That guarantees that you've got a few clock interval switches that occur often enough for this thing not to lose clock lock. So that's one thing that can happen. And there are like two other problems. There's also a CRC on the link. You can get a CRC link failure and then a different loss of framing. So my benchmark, because really the benchmark is sort of a test platform for the driver. So the driver keeps getting more and more sophisticated in order to deal with what we're actually finding in the field
the
as a consequence
world.
Of all yeah. of all exactly of a consequence of all these tests. And for a few brief hours Sunday afternoon, there were no known problems with the AHCI driver code.
Well.
But then yesterday, a new problem with a Samsung 860 EVO on an AMD chipset appeared. And if the problem appears to be the way I'm resetting the SATA port. So it turns out different chipsets want it to be done differently. So I may need to make my port resetting logic a little more heuristic than it currently is. But this is the way the sausage is made. You know, what this iterative, painstaking process will eventually produce is what everyone wants, a single AHCI driver for SpinRite that's smart enough to work on every machine and drive it will ever encounter and to provide you with information that Windows and other OSs were hiding from you.
Yeah.
So
very useful.
We're getting there.
You do need, it makes sense. You have to distinguish between bad data and a bad cable. That makes perfect sense.
Yes.
Yeah, bad connection. Yep. Let's take a break. I want to talk about Geneva. First, a word from our sponsor, IT Pro TV. I know a lot of you, just by virtue of listening to this show, are practically IT pros already. How would you like to get paid for it? What a great career to be an IT professional. And what's nice is there's a lot of different areas. There's security, networking, desktop support. You need all forms of training when you're entering a new field. And IT Pro TV makes sure you get it all when you learn IT. Their IT instructors make learning and entertaining. They also provide you with virtual labs so you can try out the skills you've learned even if you don't have those systems. The virtual lab's great. Any HTML5 browser, you can set up a Windows server, clients, the whole thing. And if something goes wrong, you just close the tab. I love it. I wish it were that easy in real life. You don't have to buy expensive hardware. You don't have to set it up. Run your virtual machine with multiple instances of Windows Server and desktop clients. And you can run it anywhere, OS X, Linux, iOS devices, Windows, obviously. IT Pro TV gives you the chance to be really ready for that cert, to get that test, to get that job. They've got practice tests. So you have the confidence to go, you know what? I aced the practice test. I'm ready. And every cert, by the way, exams from Microsoft, CompTIA, EC Council, PMI, all and more, many, many more. With IT Pro TV, you also have the chance to supplement your education with webinars featuring hot topics in the tech world and podcasts, too. Great events. We're working on an event with them right now. Check out their new podcast, Technado, with Don Pezet, featuring industry guests and IT news recaps. IT Pro TV makes sure you have a well-rounded education that'll set you up for success on your future IT career. Also, if you don't try all the different things and at least examine them, you won't know which one you like best. They even have career guidance counselors that can help you pick the field you care about the most. Last time we checked in, it was 4,000 hours. They now have 5,800 hours of on-demand IT training, and they're making more every day. I mean, there's no better place than IT Pro TV for getting started or expanding your IT career. Whatever the cert, A+, CCNP, all the CompTIAs. In fact, IT Pro TV is the official training partner for CompTIA. So they have 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. You can take courses for networking skills, security skills, Linux, Apple. The sky's the limit. Enjoy it all. And, you know, if you get the premium membership, then you got the run of the place. You can spend as much or as little time on any topic as you want. They will get you that help, though. An expert can guide you with setting goals, implementing a program so that you can reach your IT goals. August is DevOps month at IT Pro TV. In fact, they have a free Python weekend coming up where 5 Python courses will be available at no cost. They do so many fun things. Invest in yourself and your future with really great guys and gals who know how to teach IT and who have fun doing it. IT Pro TV. The experts are there waiting to help you. Go to itpro.tv/security now. We've sent so many people there from Security Now. When I visit with IT Pro TV, everybody says, say hi to Steve. Use the code SN30 while you're there. You'll get 30% off your subscription, all the consumer subscriptions for the life of your subscription, as long as you stay active. That's a pretty good deal, 30% off forever. itpro.tv/security now. Remember that offer code, SN30. IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career. Enjoy the journey. itpro.tv/security now. Thank you to the guys and gals at IT Pro TV. They're doing the most important work. They're helping people get work, get jobs in a field they love, a lifetime of learning, a lifetime of
fun, and a lifetime of good earnings. Earnings and learnings ahead for you. itpro.tv/security now. Now it's time to talk Geneva.
So this is really interesting. China's Great Firewall tightens. A few weeks ago, China added a rule to block one of TLS 1.3's new privacy-enhancing features, ESNI, Encrypted Server Name Indication. Remember that once upon a time, a single IP address could only be bound to a single web server certificate. When any client connected, a browser, the web server listening at that IP's port would respond with a certificate for the domain that was associated with that IP. This prevented the practice that is now very common and crucial, especially for IPv4, known as multiple hosting. Multiple hosting allows multiple separate domains to all point to the same single IP. But for that to work, the client, typically a web browser, must somehow indicate from which among multiple possible domains at that IP it wishes to be served. So an extension was added to SSL to allow the client's SSL hello handshake packet to make that specification clear. The web server answering at that IP would inspect the client's incoming SSL hello packet. If it was in possession of a valid web certificate matching the domain the client was requesting in that hello packet, the web server would select that certificate for the subsequent SSL negotiation and would also remember which website to serve to the client when it then made its first URL request. From a privacy standpoint, the trouble with this is that the so-called SNI, server name indication, necessarily had to be provided to the server right up front before the SSL connection's privacy encryption could be established. So that allowed any passive eavesdropper to easily determine to which domain this pending SSL connection was being directed. And one could imagine if you were China running the Great Firewall, you would be interested in secure connections coming up and to which domains they are going to. But this overt lack of privacy drove those evolving the TLS standard to work out a means, which is present now in TLS 1.3, of adding encryption to the SNI extension to create ESNI, encrypted server name indication. This is good for user privacy, but of course, it's a bane for anyone having any anti-privacy agenda, such as presumably the Chinese state, which we know has a manifest interest in controlling and censoring what its citizens are allowed to and able to access. Since adoption of new security standards is notoriously slow, this wasn't initially a problem for China. But as TLS 1.3 usage has continued to grow, the growing usage of ESNI as a feature of TLS 1.3 had been giving Chinese censors some headaches. I have a chart in the show notes, which is encouraging. This shows as of the beginning of 2018, so 2.5 years, where the various SSLs and TLSs are. And where we are now, the bottom two lines today, SSL 2 and SSL 3, looks like less than maybe 10% SSL 3, but steadily dropping. TLS 1.2 is on the rise. 1.1 is dropping, 1.0 is dropping, and 1.3 is also on the rise. So looks like TLS is almost at 100% support, and TLS 1.3 is currently at nearly one-third, 31.7%. So definitely on the rise. And that means that nearly a third of connections with clients supporting it at the client end and servers supporting it at the server end would be blinding the Chinese firewall to who they're connecting to. And as I noted at the top, it turns out that China has reacted just recently, 2 weeks ago, with a bit of a heavy hand by simply blocking any TLS 1.3 connections which use ESNI. Other HTTPS traffic is still allowed through the Great Firewall if it uses an older version of TLS or non-encrypted SNI. You know, and it's unclear what China expects to have happen. TLS 1.3 and ESNI are here to stay, but, you know, perhaps not in China. Maybe browsers will add a feature to turn off encrypted ESNI and just fall back to SNI, which would still give you the other benefits of 1.3, but allow China to eavesdrop. I found an entry in the IETF list archive dated from just a couple weeks ago, July 30th. It was titled in brackets TLS, and then it said possible blocking of encrypted SNI extension in China. And the posting said the Great Firewall of China may have identified and blocked Cloudflare's ESNI implementation. He said, the poster said, I have found that when using a TLS client hello with ESNI extension to connect to servers behind Cloudflare's CDN, the connection will be cut off after the whole TLS handshake is done. And then that IP address will be blocked at the TCP level for several minutes. Some additional probing of the phenomenon revealed that the detector is not merely matching on the lack of plain text SNI, it is specifically looking for the ESNI extension identified by the identifier. It's in hex, so 0xFFCE. Also, the encrypted server name extension must be syntactically correct. So it's actually parsing the extension. This poster wrote, the detector is not just looking for the byte pattern FFCE. And of course, we know that's good since no one wants false positive triggering of the Great Firewall's block on this. Actually, no one wants any triggering of the Great Firewall's block. He said, once an ESNI containing client hello is detected, the firewall drops packets in the client to server direction for between 120 to 180 seconds, so 1 or 2 minutes. And he says the detector, that is this block, is running on all TCP ports, not just 443. And it's already known that most functions of the Great Firewall work bidirectionally, and this new ESNI detection and blocking does too. Sending an ESNI containing client hello from outside China to a server inside also results in temporary blocking. And this, of course, is convenient since it allows for external experimentation probing with inbound connection packets. And this brings us to Geneva, which is the acronym for genetic evasion. A web browser's access to the domain https://censorship.ai redirects its visitor to https://geneva.cs.umd.edu, umd.edu being the University of Maryland. CS obviously is CompSci. And Geneva is the project within the computer sciences department at University of Maryland. It is an experimental genetic algorithm that attempts to discover, and I should say successfully, but we'll just say attempts to discover, how to evade censorship. by manipulating the packet stream on one end of the connection to confuse the sensor. Geneva consists of two components, its genetic algorithm and its strategy engine. The strategy engine runs a given censorship evasion strategy using active network traffic. The genetic algorithm is the learning component that evolves new strategies using the engine against a given sensor. Being a genetic algorithm inspired by biology, and just as biological systems compose simple building blocks, in the case of our DNA, A, T, C, and G, Geneva generates new algorithms by compositing just a few simple ways of manipulating packets. Specifically, it can duplicate, tamper, drop, or fragment packets. Geneva composes these individual actions into action trees. Action trees have a trigger. This controls which packets the action trees act upon, and together, these action trees form censorship evasion strategies. Geneva initially creates many random individual strategies and runs each of them against real sensors. Based on how successful they are and other factors, it assigns a numerical fitness to each individual strategy. The most fit survive from one generation to the next, and Geneva mutates and mates strategies to create new ones. The key to Geneva's success is its fitness function, which encourages the genetic algorithm to explore the space of strategies that does not damage the underlying TCP connection, because, of course, we want connections to still work. Over many successive generations, if Geneva discovers a strategy that defeats censorship, the fitness function encourages the genetic algorithm to refine and simplify the strategy. So one way to think of this is to compare it with fuzzing, which we've talked about often. In fuzzing, we generate entirely random, you know, junk within the limits of the target API's parameters, and we just throw it at the target to see what happens. So Geneva is a bit like that, but it adds memory and much more goal direction choosing for successive strategies. And unlike previously work of this sort, censorship evasion strategies are not manually created. Geneva discovers them automatically. Once Geneva has discovered a means of evading censorship, only then is that means analyzed manually to learn more about how the sensor operates. In this case, the work has led to interesting insights, like how China's Great Firewall synchronizes its state or how it processes packets. Sometimes the analysis concludes that Geneva has discovered a bug in the sensor. An example is the segmentation species Geneva discovered in China against the Great Firewall by segmenting the forbidden request twice at specific indices. Though the Great Firewall can normally reassemble segments, by segmenting twice at these specific bounds, the sometimes less than Great Firewall can be tricked into ignoring the request to evade censorship. As it turns out, this whole scheme actually works. Geneva has been deployed against real-world sensors in China, India, Iran, and Kazakhstan. It has independently discovered dozens of strategies to defeat their censorship and found previously unknown bugs in sensors. And what's more, all of these strategies and Geneva's strategy engine are open source on GitHub. And 4 days ago, the ESNI plugin was added to the repository. I have a link to the repository in the show notes. In the case of China's ESNI triggered blocking, they trained Geneva over the span of 2 days, 48 hours, both client side and server side. They discovered 6 strategies to defeat the ESNI censorship, 4 which worked from the server's end, and 6, including those 4, which worked from the client. And they are wacky stuff that wouldn't ever occur to someone. Okay, I have the first 2 just because they were really interesting. Strategy 1 that was discovered was the triple SYN. It operates by initiating the TCP 3-way handshake with 3 SYN packets such that the sequence number of the 3rd SYN is corrupted. Who would ever think of trying that? This strategy performs what they called a desynchronization attack against the Great Firewall. The Great Firewall synchronizes on the correct sequence number, so it misses the ESNI request. It can also be applied on the server side. This means that citizens inside China could successfully connect to secure and private services operating outside China if those services added this wacky triple SYN hack to the server. And they might only do this for client IPs originating from China. The second example of a different strategy is they called the 4-byte segmentation. The client sends the ESNI request across 2 TCP segments such that the first TCP segment is less than or equal to 4 bytes. This is not the first time Geneva has discovered segmentation strategies, but it's surprising that this strategy works in China. The Great Firewall has been famous for its ability to reassemble TCP segments for almost a decade. The TLS header is 5 bytes long. So by segmenting specifically the TLS header across multiple packets, they hypothesize that this breaks the Great Firewall's ability to protocol fingerprint ESNI packets as being TLS. This has interesting implications for how the Great Firewall fingerprints connections. It suggests the component of the Great Firewall that performs connection fingerprinting cannot reassemble TCP segments for all protocols. And they decided that this theory was supported by other segmentation-based strategies identified by Geneva in the past. So, like the first strategy, this can also be triggered server-side because by reducing the TCP window size during the three-way handshake, the server can force the client to segment their own request, which is actually a very clever hack. And their report on how this all works goes on like that. I have a link documenting the entire suite of censorship bypass strategies in the show notes for anyone who's interested. And of course, it's true. This is a cat and mouse game, very much like the virus and antivirus game. China could, and eventually I'm sure will, respond with fixes for the problems that Geneva has found, especially since the entire effort is open and public. It's on GitHub. And maybe after that, additional ways or new ways will be found around filtering. But I think the larger implication here is for the application of this sort of AI-ish directed discovery being applied to software vulnerabilities, not just communications vulnerabilities. I drew the analogy earlier to fuzzing. We might call random fuzzing, you know, dumb fuzzing, which begs the question, could we make fuzzing much smarter and more effective by adding a layer of goal-directed AI to the process, which I guess would bring us smart fuzzing or maybe super fuzz, and we might get more security as a result. But it does look like we're beginning to see more and more AI-style concepts being employed to security, and that's all for the good.
It's kind of interesting. So basically, it picks its strategies at random.
Yep.
And just keeps trying and trying and trying until something works.
Yes, exactly. and then it finds something, and then it tweaks it to see if it works better or worse, to see if it's able to improve the way it works, and it may mate that with some other things, and it might get something even better.
Right.
And it may mutate them to see if it gets something better. So I mean, it is doing, you know, sort of a success directed walk.
It's like a brev walker. It learns
exactly
how to attack and gets better.
Yep.
You know, honestly, using this to attack the Great Firewall of China is going to have, I think, limited success. Mostly what they're doing is helping patch it, frankly.
Yes.
What they're doing is pen testing on behalf of the Chinese government, because...
And there's nothing prevents, since it's on GitHub, nothing prevents the Chinese government
doing it themselves,
from running it themselves,
right,
and looking at the things it finds.
Right. Actually, what really is intriguing about this in the long run is, imagine as these get smarter and smarter, these are little agents, and it's completely autonomous, Steve, or semi-autonomous? What is there any input? It's completely autonomous.
Yep.
I think this is a terrible idea. I can just imagine these things going around looking for vulnerabilities all the time.
Yeah.
How do you stop it?
Yeah. You can imagine, had you aimed this at port 3389,
yeah,
the famous Microsoft RDP port, it would have just poked at it until it found a way in and said, and then gone, hey, found a way in.
The good news, it doesn't have a payload. It doesn't do anything. Does it report back? Who does it report to? Well,
yeah, if it were a malicious agent, it would report.
It would phone home
and say, hey, yeah, I found a gene that worked.
I think we're going to look back on this and say, shoot, this may be, I mean, it was going to happen. There's nothing you can do to stop it. I'm not convinced this is, first of all, it's not going to take ESNI down, because it's just going to find the flaws and they'll get patched. It's going to make it better, not worse.
Yep.
And in the long run, this could be a genetic experiment gone wild. All right. Yeah. I'm not going to get sci-fi.
I hope that our future overlord masters are kind and benevolent.
These bots like us. We like you, bots. We really do. That's Steve Gibson. He brings us. I mean, this show has a payload. This show is loaded like one of them Kinder eggs with a gooey inside that you just can't get enough of. I'm sorry, that's not a good description. However, I do appreciate everything you do every week, coming up with these stories, talking about it, filling us in on the latest security news. Steve Gibson, you'll find him at grc.com. That's where this thing he's working on, SpinRight. I'm going to say, Steve, this is your life's work. You've done many things, but this is your life's work. He's laboring away on it to create 6.1. You can get 6.0 right now. Guarantee yourself a free copy of 6.1 if you go to grc.com and look for SpinRight, world's finest hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. Soon to be, I mean, I really like the direction you're taking this, a diagnostic tool as well, a really useful diagnostic tool.
And you know, Leo, I forgot to mention it, but these slow spots, we're finding slow spots, which are really, it really begs the question, why is it slow? And would this mean, for example, imagine a future high-res bitmap SpinRight that showed you the speed response across the surface of your mass storage, and then zeroed in on it and worked on fixing those areas that, you know, they might be pre-failure. So there's lots of interesting experimentation coming.
Lots of ways to go with this. It's a great life project, I have to say. And I think you're going to be doing this. I see a SpinRight 10 in your future. I'm just saying, Steve. GRC.com. While you're there, you can pick up 16 kilobit audio versions of this show for the bandwidth impaired, 64 kilobit for those with ears. You can get transcripts for those with eyes who like to read along. Actually, that's really useful to get one or both of those so you can read and listen. I think that's a great idea. GRC.com, plus lots of great freebies. It's a fun site just to browse around. We have copies of the show at our website. We don't do the 16 kilobit or the transcripts. We got 64 kilobit, yes, and video. That's our our unique slice of security now. That's all at twit.tv/SN. You can watch us do the show every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, if we're on time, which we rarely are, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You know, anytime you tune in at twit.tv/live to those audio or video streams, you can, something's going on, something interesting's going on. Hang out. You know, the show will be around in a bit. twit.tv/live. Subscriptions, of course, available on all the best podcast platforms. A new one coming, a couple of new ones coming soon. But, you know, Stitcher, Slacker, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, you know the drill. Find Security Now, subscribe to it. I strongly recommend it. That way you'll have a copy the minute it's available to listen to at your leisure. Steve, have a safe week, have a great week, and we'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
I'm Jason Howell, host of Hands on Android, where each week I take a look at the Android operating system and really dive deep into what it can do for you and how it can improve your quality of life, whether it be tips and tricks on how to use it better, whether it can be little known secrets that open up a world of possibilities. So many topics to dive into, including your emails. Subscribe by going to twit.tv/HOA. We'll see you there. Security Now.